Well, hello and welcome to this edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. Glad to have you with us on this Monday morning in the city as you listen to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. A couple of interesting interviews to bring your way here today. We're going to start by going way out to Blue Springs. It's not all that far, really, just a little east on I-70. And the theater is very close to the I-70 interchange there in Blue Springs, where they are presenting Steel Magnolias, Southern Ladies of a different kind of charm. It's a relationship show. Here to tell us all about it, two of the actresses and the director, Joy Frazier Boyle, is with us. She is the director. She is also a board member of Blue Springs Theater. And she has worked really hard to get good equipment. It centers around a beauty salon. And she's worked really hard to get beauty salon style equipment there. I have to give you credit for being innovative like that.
Yes, absolutely. The show is set in the 80s, so not only are we working with beauty salon equipment, we are also working with 1980s style equipment. So my actresses are being very creative in their endeavors, as are my crew also, to come up with period specific things that will, when our audience comes in, I want them to go, wow, I used to use that hairspray, or oh my gosh, my grandmother still has those hot rollers. So that's been a big push for us.
It is more than anything else a relationship play.
It really is. It's about the women. You know, some people might say, oh, it's just a show with women in it. But these are very, very real characters. And my actresses do a fantastic job of portraying that regarding... You can see yourself in each of these characters. You can see your mother. You can see your sister. And it's actually based on a mostly true story of the playwright's sister. So it's kind of told from a little, you can tell a little bit from his perspective, but it's really about, you know, not just a mother-daughter relationship, but everyone who comes together to support each other, either in a time of need or a time of happiness.
And it centers around a town.
Yes, it's in Chicopin Parish.
It's a great southern name.
A great southern name for a great southern town. And really the show generally centers around a young woman who is getting married that day, and she comes in to have her hair done. And this just kind of tells a little bit about the story of each lady and her history a little bit, and then going forward, how that young woman, Shelby, how she lives her life.
Well, let's talk to two of the ladies you brought with you.
I did.
Let's talk about them and how they fit into this play as well. Janet Shellman is with us. She plays the role of Malin. Tell us about Malin, how she fits into the story.
Oh, Malin is Shelby, the daughter that Joy was talking about. I am Shelby's mother, and we all have our cute little accents, and Malin has always been there to take care of Shelby, and it's come a time in Shelby's life where she's getting married and she's moving on, and she doesn't quite need her mother to make decisions for her like she always did before. And Malin kind of struggles with that a little bit, but Malin is a very, very strong, strong woman, and she takes a lot of pride in being strong. And so in a part of the play, Malin actually has to let some of her emotions out, and she's not quite sure how and or why or if she should be doing that. And I think that's like the best part of the role that I get to play, because I am strong. And then at the end, I get to have my little breakdown. And
don't tell too much.
It's fabulous. It's a great. It's my dream role. Ever since I saw the movie, and the play is a lot different than the movie. So when people come, they need to realize that. You know, we're not going to be on an Easter egg hunt and all that like it was in the movie. It's strictly in the beauty shop. So it's different. But my dream role was to be Malin. I've always wanted to do that. So Joy gave me this opportunity. I'm extremely excited about it. It's going to be fabulous.
Nancy Efford is with us as well. She plays the role of Truvy. And how does Truvy, well, tell us about Truvy, how Truvy fits into this story.
Truvy is the glue. And not saying that my part is any more important than any of the others, because it's not. This is a true ensemble piece in its purest sense. But as Truvy, I've got a certain special relationship with each individual woman, and then as a whole, we come together because it's Truvy's shop, and it's a safe place. It's interesting because as Janet was talking about Malin coming in, she's been stalwart and strong, but this is the place where she can become vulnerable. All of us can, and it's a woman's place to be. Not that it's segregational or anything like that, but it's just a fact. If anybody ever has the opportunity, if nothing else, just to go and sit on a small into a smaller neighborhood lady salon, it is an absolute delight, if you will, because the conversations are all over the map. Everybody's invested in each other's lives, even though you've got that brief encounter. But these women have been together for a very long time. One of the telling lines is one that Truvy has, is that we enjoy being nice to each other because there's not much else to do in this town. And right there is actually the essence of the story. We enjoy being nice to each other, and just no matter what we're throwing back and forth.
It's not like a men's barbershop where there's really only three subjects. Let's face it, guys. There really is only three: sports, politics, and, of course, women.
Well, that's interesting because you should come to a salon once in a while. And it's really interesting if men are in our salons, and more men are doing that, they sit quietly sometimes with their hands underneath. You know, they don't know what to do because there's multiple conversations going on with multiple people at the same time, and we know exactly what's being said and done.
Now, I don't know about the others, but I do know Nancy, and Nancy actually lived down south. How much did that help you or explain things
a lot
for you?
And actually a lot. My husband was on active duty at the Navy, and we were stationed in a small town called Slidell, just east of New Orleans. And just being able to, again, live different places and see these women and see these wonderful Southern belles. And even though a lot of us were transplants, you take on that laissez-faire. You take on the really closeness, and everybody is sweetie or missy or honey. And this is prevalent in the play. And darling, and it's meant in reality. They don't take for granted any person that comes into their lives. And I think that is just a very human thing to do. And being in the South, we talk about these different desserts that we're bringing in, and the different styles, and just the different places, and how things happen. And it's exciting to know that this is based in reality, and this is a culture that we have that some people play at, we get to portray. And I think that's a huge difference in a play like Steel Magnolias, is that these characters, these women, these actors, the persons cannot be caricatures or cartoons. They are real people. And I'm very pleased the way Joy is directing this, because we are all real people with real feelings and real interactions. And the dialogue, I've read a lot of plays in my life, and this one has some of the best dialogue written I've ever seen, because it's natural, because it is based in reality. And it's just, it's sad, it's poignant and funny, just because these are people talking, and it's just, you can't make this stuff up because it's just real.
Yeah, the Southern culture, how did that affect your, or did you just pretty much leave it alone the way it was written?
No, I just kind of left it alone the way it was written, because, you know, we've talked a lot about the Southern culture, but really, it's not much different from the Midwestern culture. I mean, we all here in Kansas City, and then Blue Springs and Independence, which is where we reside, we're all kind of the same as Southern. You know, it's like Nancy had said, it's more of a human issue. It's more of a coming together to support your friends. Yes, it's based in the South, and that makes it, you know, a little bit funnier in some parts, just the way they say some of the lines, which are really, really unique for us. But really, it's just a, you know, Midwest, Southern. You could pick this particular show up and put it anywhere, because like Nancy said, it's about real women. And, you know, that might put off some of the men that might be interested in coming. But take your wives, take your sisters, take your children, because it's really, you know, it might be portrayed by women in a hair salon, but these are real emotions. that, you know, men are allowed to experience too. So I actually took my husband, we went and saw a different rendition of this show, and he had been surprised. I didn't tell him what it was about. He cried and cried and cried. So I think everybody will be pleasantly surprised if they haven't seen the show or the film. One of my big parts was, we're not trying to recreate the film. We're not trying to be Dolly Parton or Julia Roberts, who was in the original, because Truvy and Shelby, these characters, are not those actresses. Anyone can feel these same types of emotions.
Do you feel, just your own personal opinion, did the movie change much of the story? Sometimes that happens.
There's more embellishment because the play is set in one location, so obviously the movie couldn't do that and added different actors and stuff, but it's fairly true to the heart of the story, I think. So you will see different things in the movie versus the play, but the storyline and the camaraderie and the realness and your ability to find yourself in each character is still there.
I have to ask, the audition process, did ladies come up with Southern accents?
Oh, absolutely.
Was that welcome?
Would you
have rather they toned that down?
No. And I told, because I had lots and lots of ladies come audition for me. I was very, very fortunate with the group that I had come out. But, you know, I said, that's something that can be worked on. But it's funny because now we talk like this for several hours a day, every day. So I have one of my actresses who said, I just told my customer at work, you know, have a nice day, y'all, or whatever it might have been. So we find ourselves talking like this all the time now because it's just ingrained in us. And I don't have to memorize lines, thank goodness, but I'm still talking like this.
We're speaking with the director and two of the actresses in the show Steel Magnolias, opening on April 19th at Blue Springs City Theater. The number to call at Blue Springs City Theater is 816-256-1238, or you can go online to Blue Springs Civic Center. BlueSpringsCityTheater.com. The shows are, of course, at the Blue Springs Civic Center, which is part of Blue Springs High School in Independence. So you head down I-70, you get off at, if you were going east, where's the best place to get off?
Probably Highway 7 would be the best. I believe that's exit 20, possibly. Mm-hmm. 20 or 21, I can't see it in my head right now. And then when you exit, heading east, take a right, and it'll be that first main road. It's technically the outer road, right there by Winstead's. It'll kind of wind around a little bit, and then you'll come up to the high school, and it is the closest auditorium to the outer road there on, I believe it's Ashton Drive. Ashton Drive. So there's also a very lovely performing arts center that the high school uses. So the community theater is in the Civic Center. So a lot of people get a little confused about that, but that's where we're located.
Actually 2000 Northwest Ashton Drive. If you want a MapQuest, you also need the zip code 64015. Speaking with the director, Joy Fraser Boyle, and two of the actresses, Janet Shell, who plays Malin, and Nancy Eppert, who plays Truvy in the show Steel Magnolias. It opens on April 19th. There are other performers in the show besides these ladies.
There are.
Tell us about them and the roles they play.
We have an ensemble cast of six women. Like I said, I was exceedingly fortunate with the fabulous cast that I am able to work with. We have very seasoned, some not as seasoned in this area, but have worked in the past, some exceedingly seasoned actors, directors, ladies who've been in so many shows that I've, and a lot of these are actually friends of mine that I've been able to work with. I think that makes it that much better, and to really be able to feel what we need to do, and to create the kind of environment that I want to create for this show. You know, I don't know what sort of day my actresses had, but I want them to be able to come and let everything go. So Malin can have her emotional outburst when she needs to, and Truvy can comfort everyone. And there's a great actress that plays Weezer, who you all would probably remember from the movie. She's very memorable, but she just comes in and spits fire and then sits down, drinks her coffee. So it's great. She's played by Julie McDaniel.
You kind of have an all-star cast in many ways.
I was exceedingly lucky. Like I said, definitely an all-star cast. I have Julie, Jen Davis, Lene Anderson, Mary Masterson. So I have, is that everybody? I don't want to forget anybody. I didn't write it down. I should have. So yes, I've got, like I said, directors and actresses and board members, and just everybody wanted to be a part of portraying this excellent, excellent piece.
Do they really have their hair done?
Oh, absolutely. We are working on every night. We get our hair done in different ways. So,
I know Jennifer Davis. She has great hair.
She does. She has beautiful long hair.
What do you do to her hair?
Well, that's all true, V. So,
I'll tell you what I do to her hair. I make her beautiful as the most beautiful bride she can possibly ever be. And that was an interesting thing, because Jen does have gorgeous hair. There's a line about it, how so pretty and so thick, and it's true. And it's a work in progress. And when we get to opening night, we'll see how far my work has progressed. But it's been fun. I've been very patient and very understanding with people that are not hair doers, but I study the best. I have studied the best in my own salon.
So you get to see the actresses actually do the hair of the other actresses.
And Janet ends up here with rollers in her hair every night.
Every night. I will have rollers in my hair every single night. I think finally the last scene I come out with my hair.
And you get turned over to Truby.
And so. I get turned over to Truby to fix it, because I had been doing my own hair. Even though my hair looks like a football helmet, as my daughter would say in the play, Truby fixes my hair rollers.
I would think over time that would be hard on your hair. Is it?
No. Not at all.
Okay.
We use very soft rollers.
That was a concern of mine, so I wanted to make sure that we didn't damage anyone's actual hair. No actual hair was damaged in the course of this production.
It was sprayed within an inch of its life.
Yes. There may be a lot of hairspray utilized during this show. So,
well, you mentioned earlier you wanted to be authentic with
Absolutely.
The equipment of the era.
Absolutely.
So you made a deal with a salon?
I did. I have a great friend of the theater. Her name is Leah Wade. She works at Indulgence Salon and Day Spa, I believe in Blue Springs. So she has loaned us salon chairs and equipment and mirrors and all sorts of awesome things to really try to make it feel real. I don't want it to, like Nancy had brought up, a caricature of a character. It's not a spoof on anything. It's a real place. So we've studied hair salons. All my ladies have their homework to go to their own stylist and kind of take notes on things. So Leah has been exceedingly helpful in making sure. She's kind of my fact checker a little bit, like, would you actually use this in a salon? She kind of can help me out with that. So that's her trade. So she's been exceedingly helpful in that regard.
My mother worked in a salon as I was growing up. My memories as a child going to pick her up was the smell of the aroma, I should say, of permanent in the place.
Yes.
So that would make it authentic.
Yes,
for me.
That's true. We do want to be cognizant of possible allergies or anything. So you may get the aroma of Aquanet or Dippity Doo. So we are definitely, like I said, it's set in the 80s. So we've done a lot of research and trying to make sure that our Aquanet is adequately represented.
Are these ladies typical, do you think, of women down south, the way they look at things?
I think they're typical of women everywhere, mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, like Janet had said, her character, Malin, is just a strong woman. And, you know, I can see myself in that. You are strong in different places. Truby, she is the glue in a lot of places. And I know a lot of women are the glue in their family or in their unit of friends. And then Clarie and Weezer, played by Mary and Julie, are kind of almost the comic relief at times. And I know a lot of people like that, too, that just and I am like that, too. So everybody's got a little bit of their personality in each character.
Sure. The show opens on Thursday, April 19th. Then Friday the 20th, both of those at 7:30. Saturday the 21st at 7:30, a matinee on Sunday the 22nd at 2 o'clock p.m. And then a second weekend of shows, not as many. Friday the 27th at 7:30, Saturday the 28th, also 7:30, and concludes with a Sunday afternoon matinee on the 29th at the Blue Springs Civic Center, which is part of Blue Springs High School. They have a stage that can go either way.
Oh, yes. We're in the high school space, so we cooperate with them to the best of our ability so that we can all get everything done. The Civic Center has the auditorium on the one side. The other side has a cafeteria, so we are all-purpose out in Blue Springs.
I kid them all the time. You ought to do one where the audience changes places and have a new perspective.
Yes. We're just going to rotate the whole stage.
You can do that with noises off,
yes,
for instance.
Yeah. Yes.
That would have a nice dramatic effect.
Absolutely. So
they have a nice facility down in Blue Springs.
We absolutely
They're
do.
They're lucky to have it.
We are absolutely lucky to have it. We enjoy our partnership with the city and the school district to be able to bring these types of shows to our community.
And Janet, where have you been seen before? People might recognize you.
Well, I've just been right in Blue Springs at the Blue Springs Civic Center, the Blue Springs City Theater, the Independence City Theater, and out in Lee's Summit is the Summit Theater. Those are the only three that I've been. I like to stay close to home.
Okay. What about Nancy? Nancy's been around. She gives me that look like,
I've been. That sounds a little funny. I've been around. I've been privileged to be able to direct and be on stage at several of the theaters around the metro. I just recently, talking about Southern accents, I just finished The Glass Menagerie for Independence Theater, which is another Southern Belle. So I've always had pretty good luck with accents, and so that was my most recent. And I will be directing later this fall A Few Good Men for the Independence City Theater as well. And, of course, these ladies, actually, it was my joy to meet these ladies originally because they were both in Dixie Swim Club when I directed at Blue Springs. So this is a very tight family when we look around. I look around that this is kind of an ironic thing, and I don't know if Joy probably realized it. Every lady that I'm on stage with, I have directed, including the director and the stage manager. And so it's like I look around, so I sit very quietly and let everybody else do all the work. It's like I'm just going to sit here and be Truby. So.
Well, what about Joy?
I've been around a couple times too. I usually stay in Blue Springs because that's where I am and where my kids go to school. But I help out in Independence. My family's helped tremendously with Enchanted Forest. So it kind of seems like once you get with a certain group, regardless of which city technically you reside in, we all just try to support each other and support each other's work. So, you know, my family and I went to go see Nancy in Glass Menagerie, and the next one that Janet's in, we will absolutely go see her. So we travel in packs. Everyone, look out! But yes, like I said, regardless of which city we're in, we just try to support each other and support really theater in the Kansas City area.
You know, the theaters, community theaters at least, kind of thrive on the success of their volunteers. What about Blue Springs? Could they use more volunteers?
We can always use more volunteers. Absolutely. There is an email address on our website. It's bsctwebmaster@gmail.com, perhaps, and that actually comes directly to me. So if you want to volunteer, if you want to serve in any capacity, we would be more than happy to have your help and support. So just shoot me an email and we will find the best fit. Actually, there's a funny story with that. I had an email that came in from an individual who wanted to help. She just, I just want to help with steel. And I said, sure, come on down, we'll talk. She turned out to be my props manager now. She's fabulous. So she's there every night now, which I don't know if she meant to do that or not, but You know, so if you're even the slightest bit interested, we will find a spot for you. Absolutely. Several teenagers, too, that weren't necessarily right for these particular roles at this time, but I found other spots for them to contribute. I will never turn someone down who wants to learn or who wants to be a part of theater.
I've heard people say, you know, I don't really want to be in anything. I know I'm not good enough. There's something I would like to do. So they do things. And after a while, these people are chomping at the bit to do a show.
Absolutely.
To get on stage and do things. It's
yes,
amazing how
it is
they transform.
Amazing. And it's amazing, like you said, to see the transformation and to see someone come in very quietly and then they blossom. It's amazing what the stage and lights can do for people.
Sure.
It's really wonderful.
Were costumes a challenge?
Costumes are continually a challenge. We are, like I said, set in the 80s, so we're trying to be as authentic as possible. So, you know, I actually found myself some jellies, and I got Miss Janet a pair of high-waisted jeans that she's very excited to wear. Miss Nancy has some wonderful boots and some very loud geometric prints. So when you come to see our show, I hope you will see the familiarity and go, oh, my God, look at those shoulder pads, because that's really what we were striving for.
Finding things. Did you have to go through
stores? We are still, you know, we open in 10 days, so we are still working on just a couple little things. I think I've hit almost every Salvation Army and Goodwill in the KC metro area. So, but it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun to go and treasure hunt these types of things.
Oh, go ahead.
You know, Joy was talking about the pants, the jeans. We've been trying to find stonewashed jeans. She walked into the theater. I walked into the theater last night, and she said, Janet, look what I found. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I think those were my pants in the early 80s. They are totally perfect, high-waisted, not quite stonewashed, but that's what Joy has been able to do, is go out and find, like she said, the shoulder pads. And we look at things, the women that's in this, because we're all about the same age, we all look at it and go, oh, my God, I think that I used to have those when I was in my early, well, I'm not going to say. I'm in the 80s. Used to own these things in the 80s. So the women that's in the play, we know what we are supposed to look like.
And that's been a lot of fun, too, because, you know, I grew up with my sister. I was a little bit younger, but I'm not going to say either. It's just been so much fun. So
Steel Magnolias opens Thursday, April 19th. Performances continue then the 20th and the 21st, all at 7:30, a matinee on the 22nd at 2. Then a second weekend, the 27th, 28th at 7:30, a matinee on the 29th at 2 o'clock at the Blue Springs Civic Center, part of Blue Springs High School. The number to call for more information, 816-256-1238, or online at bluespringscitytheater.com. I want to thank you both, all three of you, actually, for being
thank
here
you.
Today. Janet Shellman, who plays the role of Malin, Joy Fraser Boyle, who is the director, and Nancy Eppert, who plays the role of Truvy, in the Blue Springs Civic Theater production of A Steel Magnolias, coming your way beginning on April 19th. Thanks so much for being here. We're going to take a brief break. When we return, more to Pass Your Way. You're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM. Welcome back to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, the community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us. On the second part of the show today, we're going to talk about the fabulous Frank Brothers, the musicians that were the background sound of all the big hits in Motown, especially in the 60s and early 70s. You know, Motown was in a neighborhood. It was a series of houses in Detroit in a neighborhood. Some of the houses were offices. Some of them were rehearsal areas. Some were actual studios. But it was in a neighborhood in Detroit and had an actual Motown feel to everything, Motown being the nickname for the city of Detroit. So we're going to go back a few years when I had a chance to talk to some of these guys. Some of them have passed since then, but some of them are still around. And at this time, there was a movie, a documentary film being produced. It was called Standing in the Shadow of Motown, the story of some of these musicians and what happened to them and how this particular producer that we're going to hear me speaking with got them back together, as many of them as were still alive at the time, and how they played one more time for this documentary film. So let's go back a few years now. Standing in the shadow of Motown, here's my interview with the Funk Brothers.
Well, I was really impressed with the camaraderie I noticed in the movie. There was one particular section where several of you were talking and there had been a riot had gone on. And one of you mentioned that you'd even be willing to take a bullet for your buddies.
They is. I don't think I would have.
Yeah. Was that a frightening experience?
Well, yeah, it was frightening, yeah. People say it wasn't a riot. Look, I saw white folks and black folks stealing together.
Yeah.
It was supposed to have been a riot where you're supposed to be hitting and fighting one another. They were stealing together, breaking in stores, stealing together. Right, Bob?
Yeah, he's right.
Yeah,
he's
telling you the truth.
Not only had they played together in decades, but some of them hadn't played their instrument in decades. Joe Messina, for instance, when Motown moved in 72, he stopped playing guitar and took up the chromatic harmonica. So he, a month before the movie started, he picked up, pulled his guitar out from under his bed and started getting his chops together again. Eddie Willis hadn't played in 10 years, the other guitar player, because he was on the road for 20 years with the Four Tops after Motown left Detroit. And when he stopped touring with the Tops, he stopped playing for 10 years. So he had to relearn his instrument. Now, the other guys were all playing during that time. And one of the reasons why it was able to happen was that Motown was always very easy for these guys to play, for the simple reason that in most R&B house bands, the musicians, their background was R&B, maybe a little bit of rock and roll, blues. These guys had all that, but they also were extremely accomplished jazz musicians, which takes a much higher level of dexterity and harmonic knowledge. So when they came to play Motown, it's like a weightlifter who can lift 500 pounds, but he's only called upon to lift 200 pounds. So it was easy, and the reason that Motown had the sound that it did was because it was so effortless and it swung so hard. Like Booker T and the MGs were one of the great house bands of the 60s, but they didn't have a jazz background. And their music is funk, it rocks, but it doesn't swing. And swing, you've got to be a jazz musician. A lot of the Motown songs are these, kind of shuffled like a How Sweet It Is, we hear Jameson going doom, 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 doom. It's got a deep swing to it, and it's because they were jazz musicians. So when you have this long layoff, if they were called upon after a long layoff to play jazz, this wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. But they were called upon to play something that was extremely easy for them. So even with the long layoff, when they came back to it, it was tough this time around because they didn't have the chops. Yeah, they didn't have the chops that they did, and there were a lot of health issues. But that's the reason it was able to happen. Ural, for instance, and the other drummer who unfortunately passed away, Pistol Allen, passed since the film. Neither of these guys had any business playing this movie. They didn't tell me how sick they were. Ural needed a quintuple bypass, and he had it a few days after we wrapped the shooting, and Pistol was dying of lung cancer. They had no they were risking their lives doing it. And
you'd never known that, though.
And because it was so important, because they knew their whole life, this was their whole life right here. This was their chance to say to the world, this is what I did. And they'd never get that chance again, so they weren't going to miss it. So they risked their lives to do this movie. Thank God for one and unfortunate for the other, I guess, because Pistol's not here. But I think, Pistol, if he had a choice, he would have rather had himself go out that way with his legacy preserved than to miss the opportunity.
But it wasn't so hard. But like you say, how did Siskey and Matthew get us together? That was the easy part. His job was convincing us that we could do this, because the first day I rehearsal, you talking about some strange feelings. I was scared to death. I said, shoot, I done told us less kids, that I could do this stuff. And then when it comes to the point, I said, man, I can't imagine what we're going to sound like. It was scary, And then all of us coming together at the same time, I know he hadn't played in so many years, this guy hadn't played in so many years. I said, boy, we're going to sound a mess down here. But after a few days, it just came in, and that's everything jelly came back to everybody.
Yeah, for me, it was a relief because, I went in there the first day not knowing if they could still play.
Yeah, so I know Celeste was scared.
I had 14 years in the project at that point, because I had 3 years writing a book and 11 years searching for funding. So I was like, did I just throw out 14 years of my life? I didn't know. And then within 5 minutes, we were playing Heat Wave on the first song. It was rocking. So I said, thank God, this whole thing has been a situation of being able to exhale, because we lost two guys along the way. We lost over there, like Robert White, who died before I could get funded. And, you know, I was fighting a biological time clock because, you know, their age, and I didn't want to lose anymore. And, you know, when we finally wrapped it, I knew, you know, okay, the legacy's preserved now, you know. So I could let out a...
Not saying that we're old.
You know what's funny? What did you tell me when Earl's wife said, you just said...
About you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Earl's wife said, see, this guy Slusky, he putting all this money into me. He says, one thing I can say, he got to be either that, he got to be a crazy white man or a rich white man.
Yeah, I knew he wasn't crazy because he
called, you knew he wasn't rich.
No, he called me. He said, I'm in Livonia, and I got a retainer for you. And it sort of shocked me, and I looked at it. I said, yeah, let me go out there and see him. Yeah. I knew he wasn't crazy. He had a retainer in hand.
Joe made a 30-minute trip in about 10 minutes.
How long did it take for me to make it?
10 or 15. Before, yeah, it was like, you know, I don't think Muhammad Ali, he says, I could turn off the light and be in bed before it gets dark.
It was like
before your voice faded on the phone, you were next to the house, and it was 20 miles away.
And then I knew Heat Wave, because I played on Heat Wave, but I was steadily looking at that check, and I couldn't figure out that middle part. The music up there, and I said,
"Yes, it is." The main thing, though, is not so much being a headline, but just to put our faces on the records, the tunes that we did, you know, names and faces to the tunes that
right.
we did.
And I moved out of Detroit and moved to the East Coast, and now I'm in Nashville. But I'm come in touch with a lot of musicians, and it's really hard when you're hearing stories about certain musicians that claim to have played on those records because of the, you know, there wasn't the credits on the records for a long time. That's the hardest part. And Joe Hunter's got the greatest story about Chicago. Go ahead, Joe. About meeting Joe Hunter.
Well, I knew the producer over at Chess's Records in Chicago, and he called me and said, come over and do a few tunes. I got a few tunes and I want you to touch. And when I got there, he came and got me and smiled and everything. He said, I want to introduce you to somebody. So I went to this guy. He introduced me to him. He said, this is Joe Hunter. And I said, you the Joe Hunter that worked at Motown? He says, yes. I said, you did Pride and Joy with Marvin? Yes. And I named a few other tunes. And he says, oh, you didn't give me your name. I said, well, I'm Joe Hunter, too. And he said, you Joe Hunter working. He said, come here, let me talk with you. See, I had to get this job, but I had to use a name. But he could play. He could actually play good. Anyway, he said he had to impress the people over there in order to get the job. So I said, I forgive you for the fraud or whatever, you know, for whatever you call it, using somebody else's name. I said, but don't do it no more. I said, you can go by your own name now. You got the job and you're here and they like you, you know. But he was another Joe Hunter. He was me. I met myself.
Tell him the end of it, though. Huh? Told him about giving you half of the money for the session. The reason we did that, because the movie is about, you know, everybody you talk to, you say, what's the Motown sound? They say everything but the musicians. You know, just like even in the movie, you know, there's a part in that way, you know, where I explain and say, you hear some people may say it's the food or something. I say, I like to see somebody take some pork chops, hamburger, and throw it down in that studio, shut the door and count four and get a hit, you know. But everybody, so we said this way, whatever artist we want to use, no Motown artists, and we still got the Motown sound. See, so that, you know, because like one of the guys in the group say, you could say, we used to take a chicken out off the street or something, ring his neck in the studio, and with the Funk Brothers, you got a hit.
So was it more like the artist had to adapt to you more than you to the artist?
No, it wasn't that. It's that we had the sound. And we figured the basic Motown sound. We had the group had a lot to do with it, but the basic music Motown sound with the musicians. So in order to prove it, we used artists that wasn't associated with Motown, and they sung Motown songs.
And it still sounded like Motown.
And it's still the Motown sound. That's just a different word, but it's the Motown sound.
See, the whole thing is that when you think about it, like, take the Supremes. The Supremes only sang on the Supremes. They didn't sing on the Four Tops. They didn't sing on the Vandellas. They didn't sing with Stevie. Stevie didn't sing with the Tops. Probably the busiest musician, the person at Motown, was Smokey, because he was a producer, a songwriter, and an artist. So if you take all the tracks he was involved with, maybe it's 40% of the whole company, but he's still not on the other 60%. Well, these guys are on everything. So the only continuity that ran through the Motown sound was these guys. And, most of the Motown acts, when you take the Motown acts out on the road, Barry, from the very beginning, had a different concept. He was looking for a Vegas. He was looking for this high energy. So, you know, you'll take a song that has, like, a great groove, like Get Ready, you know. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Well, when you see the Temptations play that live, you know, all these blaring horns, because he was looking for this big Vegas, you know, high energy, energy, energy. But the Motown sound wasn't about energy. It was about feel-good head-bobbing music. And that sound only came from these guys. And no other musicians could get it. And then the first thing that ever happened to me, I'll never forget, when I came out to Detroit one time, and I had never heard any of them play live. And I went to see I went with Pistol to a club, and they called him up on stage. It was funny. It was at the Beaumaxes. And Pistol walked in. Pistol was very flamboyant. There was a guy, what was his name, Robert Thrasher?
Norman Thrasher
was singing. Yeah. And he walks into, you know, I mean, this guy's right in the middle of a sensitive bout, and Pistol walks into the place, goes, Norman Thrasher, the Pistol's in the house. Right? And Norman just stopped what he was singing, and he brought him off the stage immediately. He said, ladies and gentlemen, the great Motown, John Pistol Allen, right? And he started to play, Heat Wave, which was his, one of his, because Pistol was the shuffle guy.
Yeah.
And my reaction was this, you know, because as a musician, I've played Motown songs for 35 years now. I can't tell you how many weddings and bar mitzvahs I played. The obligatory Motown medley of Get Ready, Dancing in the Streets, and My Girl, and Heat Wave. And they never sound like these guys, right? And the second I heard Pistol, this was the reaction. It was like, oh my God, that's it. That's it. You know, and I played these songs a million times with little musicians, and the first time, because it wasn't a sound. It was a sound that was the creation and the sole property of a very small group of gifted musicians. And it's proven by the fact that when they went out to L.A. and didn't use these musicians, they lost the sound.
Yeah. Most of the artists was dubbed in. Yeah. You make the band tracks a lot of times first and then dub them in.
Well, you never saw the artists.
Yes, the artists had adapted them. It wasn't adapted to the artists. In the early days, it was a give and take, because they didn't have enough tracks, everybody cut it live.
Yeah.
But, you know, once they got into, you know, 8 tracks, the artists brought, you know, these guys cut first, and then the artists came in. Sometimes they, you know, the songwriters didn't even know what artist it was going to be for. They just made them cut, then figured out, oh, maybe we'll plug this group in, maybe we'll try that group.
Well, that might be easier technically in editing, but I would think you'd lose the give and take between everyone doing it like that.
Okay, say like,
one process.
45 miles, everyone stopped. Okay, when that drum solo in there, when we cut that, when I did the drum solo, Edwin Starr dubbed in, part of that record, he's singing my drum solo with me. You know, he's singing it along with me. If I hadn't have did that solo in there, he probably put something else in there, but he sung what I was playing.
But that was also the genius of some of the producers. If they cut something and they had the idea for the song, but the artist wasn't there, and then they hear something that happened in the song, they may, for example, on some of the Supremes tunes with James's bass line, they gave to the horns to play. Now, they would have never had that horn part
as part of the arrangement.
As part of the arrangement prior to cutting that track. But once the track was cut and they felt that groove, they said, oh, let's do this. We'll have the horns do exactly what he's doing. And it also went yours said, to the vocals, too, where the vocals served certain things. And maybe if it wasn't the actual artist, the producer might have said, yeah, do it just like with the drums right there.
See, what was happening in Motown? See, a lot of other places, guys would just recharge and things like that.
Motown, they would give these guys charts, but until the very later years, they were very minimal, just basic chord charts. And if you tried to write something for like a James Jamerson, you laugh at you, take a look at the chart, yeah, you want me to play this bull? And they'd say, no, yeah. No, I want you to do your thing. Just take, it was real, you know, it was a standard thing, you just throw it there.
Yeah, he did that a lot of times in studio. Yeah. Took the music and just off there and throw it on the floor.
And just play whatever the hell he wanted. See, one of the things we're doing now is really, you know, the soundtrack is out in stores right now, and it's a 2-CD deal. The second CD will be out around January, and what we're doing is we went back into the vaults at Universal where they have all the original multi-tracks. And there's two vault tracks in there. Yeah. Keep Me Hanging On and Bernadette.
Yeah.
And we got 16 vault tracks that we pulled out, like the Diana Ross version of Inner Mountain, I Was Made to Love Her, My Guy, My Girl, a whole bunch of, and we're remixing them from the musician standpoint. So in other words, that means no vocals. And people, you know, me, said, I'm just going to do the melody. And my thing is to them is, there's different melodies. Listen to the melody on a piano. Listen to the melody of that bass. And we're basically pushing faders and mute buttons all over the place, soloing instruments. So you can hear all these incredible parts that were buried for decades under the singers. So, you know, like some, we might have a thing where you got this full orchestration. All of a sudden we hit a bunch of mute buttons, and all of a sudden it's just Ural and Jamerson. And then we pull out Ural and it's just Jamerson. And then we pull out Jamerson and it's just Ural. And you get to hear all these incredible parts. And these are songs that we all know so well. And you go, oh my God, I never heard that stuff.
We would cut sometime in the day, right? Go home, get dressed, go to night gig. And then after we get off our gig, maybe one of the artists or studio, somebody would come in, arrange or writers would come in on our gig and tell us, can we come to the studio after we get through playing on our gig?
Well, they have the Motown Museum.
Yeah.
The studio where we cut. Have only seen the film, or you want to see it tonight?
I've seen it. I have.
Okay. Well, you know where the song we did in the Snake Pit with Michelle. I think we're the first people to cut since they left there. It's been a museum for 30 years.
And, it's still workable.
No. Well, we had to bring in a mobile recording truck.
We got a jazz museum there too, Greystone Jazz.
But the other half of the film that makes this so significant. You know, one half is the music, because when you have a monumental contribution of this size, it's very significant, you know, because these guys have had the impact of the Beatles, although they were faceless. But when you, this is also a story, you know, these are magnetic, riveting characters, and we were, you know, the movie also explores their life outside of just music, you know, the trials and tribulations that they had.
Right, it was hilarious.
Yeah, exactly. Dealing with each other. And it's a great story, and just the story of these guys as a social unit, aside from the musical part. And the characters, like James Jamerson, was a tormented genius. So he was very cinematic. You know, I mean, it was very easy to do these stories around Jamerson because it's the ultimate, like, sex, drugs, and rock and roll story. And there is a basic bad guy here, which is not Berry Gordy. It's obscurity itself. And the fact that these guys have had to endure this for 40 years and have come out of it with so much dignity and grace in accepting their position, and then at the end of their lives, which hopefully will be another 40 years, they get to go out like winners. And justice is done, and the fact that they were up, you know, I think it's much sweeter that they're getting their place in the sun now than if they had gotten it earlier. So.
Yes, those Funk Brothers were really something else. I had to edit some on the text of the interview, as you probably noticed, but nice, natural guys. Hearing their story and meeting them was really exciting. These are gentlemen that paved the way. Motown, no, they weren't the main singing artist. You know, they weren't Smokey Robinson. They weren't Aretha Franklin. They weren't any of the big names, but they were just as important. And Motown, of course, had a hometown feel to it in Detroit. And if you see the documentary, Standing in the Shadow of Motown, you get a nice feel of that and all that really goes into it as well. So we want to thank them. Hope you enjoyed my interview also earlier with Orson Scott Card. He has a current book coming out. It's at the bookstores right now. And thank you so much for him, for the Funk Brothers, for the producer of the documentary as well. Thank you all for being on this best of session of the Arts Magazine program. The Jazz Insider is next. He's got some great jazz planned for you. Jazz from 1 to 3, the blues from 3 to 6, right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hoge. We'll see you next time.